had a pretty good record, so it's been a miserable this time.
Was it an injury or something? Was it an explosion?
Well, they had two kids leave for the NFL and didn't play.
Oh, can't you win something in the NFL? Or
what did you know, but
you don't have
going
to
good.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you didn't want
yeah.
to, just go enjoy what you're up to.
Oh, yeah.
You
think
yeah. yeah, I'm loving it. It's good.
You think they have more
Joyce
than
one
more
open than no place?
I don't think so.
Love to be
here.
Yeah.
With national recruiting.
Yeah, yeah. You're all in.
Okay.
Awesome in that. So.
Is anyone on the line? They're all unmuted. So we just need to, they're all on mute. Which
they're not muted, though, because that would be on.
Hi, Bill. We're going to just give it a few more minutes for people to get on the webinar and call in, and then we'll get started.
I'm
Okay.
So for those of you who are on the call, we're going to leave the phone line unmuted, but if you are not talking, we would just request that you mute your phone so we don't have any background noise. We'd appreciate that. And then when you want to speak, you could just unmute your phones. We're just trying to figure out who is on the line. So if you're on the phone, can you please announce yourself so we can figure out whether or not everybody who's presenting or a member is present for the start of the meeting? You'll have to unmute your phones. Thanks, Bill. Any of the agency researchers on the phone?
My sister's a police officer in New Jersey. She sees a lot.
Yeah,
especially the female police officers.
Anybody else on the call besides Bill? He's the only one I've heard announce himself at this point. Okay, thank you.
I teach. 50 in the legislature?
No. Let's go to the commission. Let's go.
How many years did you do in the legislature?
60.
All time?
All time, yeah.
And I've asked you before, I think Bruce is...
My uncle.
Your uncle.
How is Utah changed? Salt Lake changed?
Oh, it is.
Yeah, I just looked. Okay.
Are you excited about the changes or something?
Some are certainly a lot of it.
Feels a little congested.
Like any major metropolitan area.
You're not in this.
Which I'm curious.
Yeah.
Even in this place like Provo.
Yeah, Provo's getting really good. You see the census numbers came out, but the highest increase in population.
Utah was the highest in Utah.
Yeah, yeah. You can feel the department coming.
Oh.
The quality of life in the second space of the second is taking the time. No. That's what
it is.
Of course, this commission is completely eliminated.
Yeah, that's
really
amazing.
I'll
call
them on the phone. Yeah, if they're on through the phone, right? They all have
the
they should all have the weapons. Okay.
So, as is the case, we're having a little bit of technical difficulty. So, when you see the link for the GoToWebinar, you have to register for the webinar and then get your audio pin, and then the audio pin will allow you to actually participate. So, on the link that says GoToWebinar, click on that, register for the webinar, and then you will get an audio pin that will allow you to participate in the meeting. We think that that might be part of the challenge.
I think what's tricky is usually a sociologist will be assigning that to.
Getting audio through their laptop, you might have to mute your laptop if you're also on the phone. This is why I hate technology. Well, I think we're just going to get started.
Okay.
We think there's more people on the phone than just having problems with their technology.
Okay. Let's do it. I think we've welcomed everybody. We've chatted, right?
Yeah. Amy and Lieutenant Governor are down.
Yeah, they're down at the convention center having a discussion with their colleagues. So, and 900 other people that are watching.
Anybody else here running for governor? I mean, we might as well just hop on pitch.
Do our own debate right here on IGP.
Bless them.
Yes. Bless them for stepping up. Putting their name in the hat for that. Spencer asked if I would go ahead and run the meeting today until he arrives. So that should be shortly after 2-ish. He'll be heading this way. So welcome to everyone. Glad you made it down. Those that traveled, appreciate you being here. Those that are on the phone, which seems to be nobody at this point, welcome. Joyce, would you like to introduce yourself and who you're?
I'm Joyce Pace. I'm the trial court executive for the 5th District. Nada asked me to sit in for her because she has a working appointment that she can't get out of, so I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, thank you.
So, from our last meeting, which was months back, we heard about the 2019 report. We got a lot of great feedback from the legislature on the progress that's being made by the commission and the agencies and everyone really that's working on it. If you remember, if you recall the last meeting, we talked about Resilient Utah. Mary Beth did a presentation there, and the commission agreed to move that work forward. They are continuing to meet and put more details to that. You're on the agenda today to talk about some of that. So, or Tracy, sorry, but you can.
Don't panic.
Okay. So we'll get an update on that. Obviously, we have a full meeting, and some people have flights, right? And some people need to get on the road to head back north. So we'll try to be succinct and give people something to go along with their travel plans. Let's see here. First on the agenda, I've got three different ones in front of me, so I'll try to figure out which one is which. We don't have a quorum, so no approval of the minutes is required at this point. Nathan, I believe you're up first because you have the early flight. So Nathan, is it Alec?
Yeah.
Is from USBE. Nathan is... They've been implementing several strategies around student equity that will also address economic outcomes for students experiencing intergenerational poverty. So we put some time on the agenda for Nathan to present to the commission and the advisory committee. So the time is yours, sir.
Great. Yeah.
Tracy, do we have slides?
Oops. Caught up on it.
So my name is Nathan. I am representing the Utah State Board of Education today, and it's a pleasure and an honor to be here to speak with you about some of these things that we'll be chatting about. So I'll be talking about two larger initiatives. Initially, it'll be this Equity Lab experience that we have facilitated across the state of Utah each of the last 2 years, and then also some early learning initiatives that the State Board of Education is putting during this legislative session.
Yes.
So I'll start by describing...
We are having a hard time hearing you. It's coming very muffled, and we cannot hear you at all.
Yeah, we were having a hard time hearing you, too. You might have to. Yeah, I mean, just try to be closer to it.
Yeah,
totally.
You can
just sit down. Yeah, you could sit down.
Cool. Maybe close to the microphone.
Okay.
We're also having feedback from whoever's speaking. I don't know if you have your computer and your phone on, but there's some feedback there. And we're adjusting the microphone.
No, that we switched out the phone.
I can't.
You switched out the phone, but your voice is still coming very muffled.
I can't either. Yeah. We're having a hard time hearing you on our end as well.
Yeah, it's a beautiful view.
Sometimes it happens, you just have to roll with it.
Yeah, no worries.
Carry on.
Tracy, you want me to... I can start talking.
Yes, please.
Great, okay. So, last year, we did... The USBE created this this idea of an equity lab, which whose purpose is to facilitate conversations within... school districts and charter schools, communities across the state in order to help them identify both the gaps that they have in representation within different types of programs, as well as to come up with strategies that are germane to their community. Classically, a lot of initiatives associated with equity have been kind of one-size-fits-all solutions, and so with the Equity Lab, it's less USDE coming in and telling LEAs what should be done in order to increase equitable circumstances for their communities, but rather empowering them to identify solutions to gaps that show up kind of objectively within the data.
Good question. When you say gaps, do you mean achievement gaps, or what kind of gaps are you doing?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it depends on the Equity Lab. So the first year, Equity Lab 1.0, which was the 2018-2019 school year, we were identifying and kind of analyzing circumstances associated with students having access to really effective teachers. And so in that case, it was kind of an opportunity gap, I think, would be the best way that we describe it. And so this year, we took a similar model and we applied it to students' access to early college coursework as well as CTE coursework. So kind of college and career readiness was the vision that we pursued in this space.
And that's for the state of Utah.
Yeah, so all LEAs charged across the state had the opportunity to participate. And in each of the cases, we would kind of take those that were presenting to different regions throughout the state, and then charters and school districts that were in the vicinity had the opportunity to come and participate. So it was a full-day experience, about 8 hours long. And during that time, I'll get into in a little more detail what this year's Equity Lab looked like. But basically, it's walking participants, and oftentimes participants didn't include just a single member from a school community, but rather, in some cases, we had 6 and 8 member teams coming from those communities in order to have conversations surrounding, there would be one teacher member and one principal member and one school district member, in some cases superintendents participated, and specialists within mathematics or science or ELA. And so they would all have conversations, first off, analyzing the data and the opportunity gaps that their community had within those spaces, and then as the day wore on, identifying root causes of why are these gaps existing, and then finally at the end of the day, coming up with a theory of action and an action plan in order to start closing those gaps going forward. And so, as I mentioned last year, this process was done with effective students' access to effective educators, and this year we kind of pursued it in the college and career readiness space. So I have a little bit of data, if we end up with the slides up here, that I can show you what these gaps kind of look like. But ultimately, the pursuit is trying to take this idea of equity that for a number of years has been kind of enculturated into our educational community. Initially, it was kind of within the classroom. How can we serve individual students better? But as the educational community dug into this idea, it's turned out that it's applicable to all kinds of kind of educational structures throughout educational communities. And so there was all kinds of ideas that LEAs had in order to close those gaps, ranging from kind of undercutting ability grouping within high school structures. So what that looks like, oftentimes it's also referred to as tracking. And so what ability grouping looks like is there's some sort of assessment that students get around ninth grade, say in mathematics, and then there's tracks that form. There's maybe a gen ed track, maybe there's a remedial track, and then there's like an honors track. And what we find is in these cases, the students that are put into remedial tracks oftentimes don't ever have the opportunity to get out of that track. And so they lose opportunities as they near graduation or graduate with college and career beyond that high school graduation. And so there's a number of districts that have looked at their tracking procedures within their district and started to kind of unravel that process and offer teachers professional learning opportunities on more effectively differentiating for students of a kind of broader achievement and classic experience level within in mathematics or ELA or whatever the circumstance is. And again, I have some other examples that I can speak to.
Does that include gifted and talented and special ed? or is it just within classroom building groups?
Yeah, so it depends on the circumstance, but broadly, what we see is oftentimes special ed students receiving special education services are placed in those remedial tracks, despite the fact that oftentimes their IEPs are suggesting that those students don't need special education services for the subject in question. So again, if it's mathematics, students can get into receiving supports for, say, reading in special education, but then end up in a remedial track for mathematics. And so this has been problematic for a number of years within communities across the country. And so this is just one idea that communities have started to kind of look at as a strategy for closing those achievement gaps across underrepresented groups. So beyond this kind of process focus on equity, not as just a classroom initiative, but also like an institutional initiative, it's also moving towards objectivity. Equity has become such a big term that now when people say equity or equitable practice, oftentimes they can mean different things. And so when we're talking about a gap analysis or looking at opportunities,
I can advance the slide. You got to advance the slide.
Cool.
Okay, she'll control the slide.
Awesome. We can move a couple past this one. And then, yeah, we can be, this one is a great one to start on, and I'll move it forward in just a second. We're starting to with a gap analysis, we start to have move towards an objective view, or a view that is hard to argue with regards to what equity looks like. And so through this kind of gap analysis, we empower communities to be able to come up with solutions for themselves. And just in case no one has seen this, classically we treated education as this kind of equality circumstance in which what was the most fair was giving all students the same thing. But if we look at education as an opportunity for every student to succeed, then what we want to do is move towards this equity space. And this is the idea that our equity labs are based upon, which is giving each student what they need when they need it in order to experience success. And so as opposed to giving all students the same supports, we try to give all students the same opportunities to succeed. And that's what the equity labs are.
Let me ask you a question. Practically, in a classroom, how does a teacher manage that kind of a scenario?
Yeah.
If everybody is in a different, all the kids are at a different spot.
Totally.
How does that practically work?
So it's a challenging one, but the basis of it is improving what we call differentiation within the classroom. And that means providing instruction that students of different experience and achievement, classic achievement levels, can all grow within. It's a big question, one that I can't speak to specifically today, but there'll be a number of kind of initiatives that LEAs are pursuing within that space, trying to make to help teachers become better at doing just that.
But aren't Title I schools examples of that, where they provide more services for schools that have a high level of free reduced lunch students?
Yeah, and so I think that, and this is kind of a generalization, that oftentimes Title I schools place more focus on professional learning related to differentiation because the students that they have coming in have a broader range of achievement levels classically. And I think as we move forward and this idea of equity kind of permeates all kind of educational like silos, so to speak, I think like differentiation has become really important to all schools, not just alternative schools and not just schools serving socioeconomically disadvantaged students. So if we could go to the next slide. The basis of how LEAs or charters and school districts are pursuing this work is by determining which student groups are underrepresented. And so what we define underrepresented as is a student group that holds a smaller percentage in a program as compared to the overall LEA population. Now, this is a little bit confusing, but the idea is if we take an entire school district and look at the percentage of students in that school district that are socioeconomically disadvantaged, And then we look at all of the students that are in accelerated courses and what percentage of those students are socioeconomically disadvantaged. If there's a difference between those, we define that as an opportunity gap. What we expect to see and what we would like to see is that the percentage of the entire community, the entire school district, is the same as the percentage of students that are in programs in the, our Equity Lab 2.0, that early college coursework. At least one course, either in advanced placement, concurrent enrollment, or international baccalaureate classes. We would expect to see these percentages the same. But when we look at statewide data, as well as school district and charter-wide data, we're not seeing those percentages being the same. Can we go to the next one? And let's actually go one more. So here's race and ethnicity trends within early college courses. What we see is Asian students at the top, and then white and multiracial students are these two lines. They kind of track together. And then we see Hispanic, Pacific Islander, African American, and American Indian as we go down the chart. So in a perfect world, what we would hope and want to see is all these lines are tracking the same. There's no difference in achievement levels or opportunities based on a student's race or ethnicity. But what we can see is there's actually a 40% gap between the lowest achieving race and ethnicity and the highest achieving race and ethnicity. And these are the gaps that we're trying to help empower LEAs to come up with solutions in closing. Can we go to the next one? And so we see something very similar within socioeconomics, English learners, and students receiving special education services. So we have non-low-income students as the top line, and then low-income students is the next line down. The top is non-low-income, and then the middle one is total, meaning all students. And so low-income is this yellow. And again, we see between 23 and 38. That's our gap that we're looking at. This is a 15 to 17. I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are. But we have a 15 to 17% gap in opportunities for students that are from low-income backgrounds. But there's no reason that their opportunities should be any less than those students that are in non-low-income backgrounds. Something else that we see in these charts, and both is the case, is that they're pretty flat. Going forward, something that we're hoping to see is that the percentage of students in early college coursework at some point within their high school career is trending upwards. And just this last year, we're starting to see a little bit of that trend. You can see that there's a slight upward tick at the end of those graphs.
I'm just curious, what if you randomly assign low-income students into these college coursework? Do you think there would be an overall difference in their outcomes compared to the control group?
Yeah, so I didn't include this slide. It's a great question. But what we see, and this is correlative, not causation-based, but what we see is roughly a doubling in the likelihood of students entering college within 2 years after graduation if they've taken at least one of these experiences, one AP course, one concurrent enrollment course, or one IB course. It's roughly 25% for low-income students if they don't take one of those courses, and it's slightly over 50% if they do. Again, this is correlative data, but it's a trend that's worth noting. Great question. And so we actually see very similar trends within the CTE space. I won't speak much about that today, just from a time perspective. But we see these same trends that not everyone has the same opportunities and that gaps exist, not only within the state, but also within LEAs. And so when LEAs look at this data, they say, okay, so these are statewide trends, but that doesn't apply to my community. My community is doing all these things in order to prevent that, or maybe they're not. So what we did with Equity Labs is we pulled data specific to each of the communities that was participating. And so they're not using statewide data to make decisions about their local community. They're making decisions based on the data that their students are experiencing. And so let's go to the next slide. I don't expect anyone to be able to see all these numbers, but what I want this to kind of help you understand is what the data look like for LEAs when they're making these decisions. So they have data associated with a number of categories. We see gender. We see income levels. We see race and ethnicity. We see English learners. And we see students receiving special education services. And so they can take that data and compare their overall population to their each of these student groups and see if those gaps that I was talking about before exist. And then they can identify which underrepresented group has the most concerning gap. And within the Equity Lab, once they identify that, then we start into this process of facilitating a conversation around how they're going to close that gap. Let's go to the next one. So it starts with a root cause analysis. A root cause analysis is a potential reason for the occurrence of a problem. And so they all sit around in their table. In some cases, there's eight folks from different kind of spaces within their LEA, and they talk about what could be causing this gap to exist. Why are students that are socioeconomically disadvantaged not seeing the same level of opportunity within concurrent enrollment courses as compared to all their other students? And so they can come up with a number of issues. Maybe it's their counseling practices. Maybe it's the expectation of a teacher referral. Maybe it's summer expectations. In many AP programs, there used to be summer reading requirements that board rule recently made illegal. And so there's all kinds of these potential causes that could be leading to these gaps. And so after they have conversations about what those potential causes might be, they come up with a theory of action. So a theory of action describes how we'll move our organization from the current state to a desired state. So a theory of action says, understanding that we have this gap in, for example, socioeconomically disadvantaged students' access to concurrent enrollment courses, if we provide professional learning for our counselors in order to empower all students to enroll in these courses at a similar rate, we'll see that gap start to shrink. So that's what a theory of action says. So after they've identified all kinds of root causes, they start to hone in on just a few root causes, and then they write theories of action in order to determine if we do this, then we can assume that this is going to happen. And they can start to analyze their assumptions to ensure that whatever strategies they come up with are going to be effective. And so once they have landed on theories of action that kind of solve those root causes, then we move to what actions will be taken during what time period to enact your theory of action. This is, for the next year and a half, what are we going to enact within our communities in order to undo these gaps? And so what we see, this is broadly, some people refer to this as a design thinking process. And we see design thinking being applied in a number of sectors within the economy. Business is actually where it started, I believe. But through this process, we can help LEAs not only come up, ensure that the root causes that they came up with are associated with the gaps that are most concerning for them, but also analyze the strategies that they're using in order to close those gaps so that they come up with what they think is going to be the best implementation plan possible. But it's just that initially. It's just an implementation plan. And so what we have them do is fill out this card that we then send to them 6 months later. So in 6 months, what do we want to see within our LEAs? And then we come back 18 months after that to analyze, was the implementation efforts that they put into play, are they being ineffective? If so, we're going to see that gap start to shrink. If not, we need to shift implementation in order to constantly be evolving and ensure that the energy and the money that we're putting into these problems are bearing fruit, so to speak. Let's go to the next one. So these are some of the, as I was mentioning before, these are some of the things that LEAs across the state came up with this year for closing those gaps in early college coursework. So we see, like I mentioned, stop ability grouping and start supporting this idea of differentiation. We see LEAs putting into play a consistent and kind of analytical process to looking at their data with, in some cases, weekly, to ensure that their students are getting what they think they need. Plans for college and career readiness happening within the counseling space starting in middle school and offer students opportunities to come up with a trajectory for achieving whatever it is that they want in the college and career readiness space during and then after high school. Use diverse student ambassadors to kind of engage students of diverse backgrounds to be able to identify themselves as a college-going student. To change counseling practices, leverage social media using diverse voices, and survey students. Ask students, what is the best things that, what could we have done to get you more engaged in these types of classes? So, I won't speak too long about this, but this is, Equity Lab is kind of our culminating efforts in helping underrepresented student groups increase access within both AP, IB, GT, gifted and talented, as you mentioned before, and CE, concurrent enrollment experiences. And so over the last 3 years, we've convened stakeholders groups from across the state in order to adopt a vision and timeline for how, what are we going to do as a state in order to start to decrease these gaps. Just in August, we passed the kind of evolution of Board Rule 277-707, which governs funding connected to AP, IB, and GT. Concurrent enrollment will be next, but now there's expectations within the application for these funds for school districts and charters to be doing this work, exactly the work that I'm talking about, exactly the work that we're doing in Equity Lab. They have to identify underrepresented groups, and then over time, we have to see those gaps closing for them to continue to be have access to the funding that's within this space. And then the Equity Labs are the first step in our statewide implementation support for this work. So I think we're going to go a couple slides. So let's go back one. Yep, we can stay here to see about questions. So these are all the things that kind of showed up within the board rule. For time's sake, I won't speak about all of them specifically. But at this point, before I kind of shift to early learning initiatives, I'm happy to answer any further questions that we have about this kind of Equity Lab process.
When will they be reporting back to you on any outcomes that are emerging from what they're instituting?
Mm-hmm. So we didn't mandate that LEAs participate in Equity Labs if they're applying for those funds. So all the school districts and charters that are applying for the funds related to EASB report back in the summer. And so that'll be the first kind of baseline reporting that we'll have available. And so from that point, what we'll basically be looking at is implementation. Did you put things in play that was looking to close these gaps? Because we don't have baseline data to kind of compare it to. But then a year from this upcoming summer, a year from the 2020 summer, we'll have that baseline data that came from this summer, and we can actually start looking at closing gaps from that point on. So kind of analysis for that data, and then their implementation, whatever they're going to do connected to closing those gaps, is due by the start of the school year, so that they can look at their data, do the analysis, and then put into play the new strategies that they think will be most effective at closing those gaps.
How many LEAs have applied for these funds and are participating?
That's a great question. Last year, we had close to 100. I don't know the split exactly. So that's the vast majority of school districts, and then maybe 60 charters or so. This one of the legislative requests we have this year is to increase the amount of funding that goes into AP, and so with those increased funds, it'll be more likely that LEAs will look at the amount that they would be getting and find it worth their while to apply. In some cases, LEA's allocation is $140. It's just dependent. It's a formula based on enrollment within AP coursework as well as passing test scores, or a 3, 4, or 5 on an AP test.
I'm curious about your root cause. I'm assuming that when you're talking root cause, you're talking with them in the educational system, kind of the systems level root cause rate, because if some of the root cause could be that mom and dad are from a lower socioeconomic.
Sure.
So, Can you explain just a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And honestly, the root causes that folks within the Equity Lab talk about were pretty broad, because there is some access to parent communication. So parent outreach is one thing that LEAs talk about really consistently, and kind of communication and messaging. So from that kind of lens, there is some access between like institutional structures and kind of home experiences. But you're right, largely what the root causes they're looking at are things that they have control over within the school day. Kind of coursework availability based on schools. What you'll see is sometimes in wealthier neighborhoods, there's all kinds of advanced coursework or early college coursework available. And then when you go to an alternative school, there's no coursework available. That big data set that I showed you for just a second, high school 3 on that data set is 0% for everything because they don't offer any early college coursework.
The closing gaps would require root causes outside of the school's control.
In a perfect world, like school communities would have access to everything, and the conversations that we have are like, what is within our power? What levers can we pull that are most powerful in setting students up for success within this space? And so you're right. There are some things that school communities don't have access to.
My only concern is we punish schools for things they can't control. So a school serving a really disadvantaged neighborhood would appear to be the culprit when there's a lot of factors beyond their control. And is there a way to kind of adjust expectations to account for that, or is it too difficult to
isolate? I think so. And it's a question that's still kind of open, which is, like, how much progress is enough progress, right?
Your baseline will help with that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Because we don't have a baseline yet, like, that conversation will start in earnest once we see that baseline data. But ultimately, in similar, as the educational community broadly has started to shift, at least somewhat, from this idea of proficiency to growth scores, right, when we talk about standardized assessments. And I think that there is something similar that can apply here, in that we're not penalizing communities for where they're at to begin with, but what we expect is that there's progress on a kind of yearly basis. And what expectations are related to that progress, maybe I can come back in a year and speak more to what that might look like.
I have two questions. It would be interesting to have kind of a community resilience measure of some sort to then compare apples to apples at a statewide level to say, here's the community level, here's the baseline, and here's, I don't know, you bring it. It would be interesting to kind of do that at a level so you can really understand apples to apples and then see the progress, like in Ogden High, right? That also has an IB program. I have some IB mom. So anyway, my point is, my second question is longer term than from the district through the Equity Lab idea, are there plans to, or what are the plans in this repos idea that they cannot control to link in then with the poverty initiatives and all of those things that are actually going on to maybe solve some of those issues?
Totally. But the first thing that I would say is I think it's a fantastic idea that apples-to-apples comparison. We see the same thing in assessment growth scores, right? Is that students that scored a particular way in one year, in the subsequent year, when you compare their kind of expected growth is compared to students that scored similarly to them the year before, right? And so something again, there could be a parallel circumstance in which we do that within this space. Again, this is all kind of spitballing. And from a kind of forward thinking trajectory or perspective, the next kind of step that we're moving on in this space is to identify some LEAs that have shown significant gap closing or significantly small gaps to begin with, and empower them to share their best practices across communities. We're creating a kind of early college coursework professional learning community that has met now in a couple weeks. It's meeting for the second time this year. And so that'll be a kind of conduit to share best practices across communities. With regards to linking into other initiatives, we've heard LEAs talk about doing that within the Equity Lab space. And at this point, there's no formal expectation that that happens, but it's a great idea, for sure. And it's something I'll definitely take back to my team and consider how we can kind of incorporate it.
So High School 3, you talked about the fact that some programs they couldn't offer. Do you give... did you look at early releases or tech college programs or things like that in this?
So we offered school districts and charters data connected to CTE experiences within within their population, and they were a lot of them also pulled their own data from a statewide perspective. I could be wrong about this. I would have to ask our the kind of data person that I work with, but I don't think that we have early release data to be able to give them. Maybe we can pull it somehow.
So the reason I question that is there's a debate on the state level that goes on because we're duplicating programs all over the place, and of course from the public education sector, they're saying, well, we have to have this. And from a higher ed's point, they're saying, we got it, just let us have the kids.
No, totally. It's a great point. And and something that came up within our team as we were talking is what are ways, and this PLC is the first step in our solution to finding ways to empower LAs to collaborate across the boundaries of their school districts or their charters, in order to pool resources and have things available for students in four different districts at the same time, potentially. So that is on our radar, and it's a great idea as well.
So from a human-centered design perspective or a design thinking perspective, usually you look at it through the lens of the client, so to speak.
Yeah.
In the equity process, did you engage students in the conversation of why? And understanding the gap analysis, did you have a student input or youth input?
So the closest that we got was that idea of student surveys being a part of a number of LEA solution sets. So their action plans include before their data is due and before they're writing their kind of implementation process for the next year, they're setting up surveys that will empower students to say what is it that they would have benefited from or can benefit from in the future within this space. So the answer is no. We didn't have any students that were that came to the Equity Lab experience, but LEAs across the board had conversations. There was no single. I was at all six of the locations, the Equity Labs, and there was conversations surrounding student survey and student input and student advisory councils and student voice at every one of those experiences.
Was it a consistent survey? I'm just curious because most kids who will finish the survey are typically the students who would.
Yeah, it's kind of so early in the process. I haven't seen any of the surveys yet. But this summer, hopefully, we'll see some.
Jenny, if you're gonna miss your flight here,
so
you either stay the night in St. George, if that's what you prefer, we can let you keep talking.
Yeah. So let me say one other thing about early learning.
Okay.
If you don't mind, I want to make sure that I get to this. And so I just wanted to share a kind of update with regards to some earlier learning initiatives that USB is pursuing. So as you probably know, USB has a strategic plan, and within that strategic plan, there's four goals that are laid out. Early learning is one of those four goals. Personalized learning, effective educators and leaders in safe and healthy schools are the others. Within this early learning space,
you'll have a packet of information.
Which
is basic analysis of how online to it. Work of the commission, so
So this is a kind of summary of what is probably in those one pages, and basically there's a pre-K, a kind of systemic effort to support pre-K through grade 3 experiences for students. And so within this space we have this early learning professional learning initiative. That's the first kind of column on this sheet that you'll be getting. Basically this is asking that asked, a legislative ask for roughly $18 million in order to provide professional learning experiences for all elementary teachers in both ELA and mathematics in PK through grades 3. And additionally, some coaching resources for rural districts that don't currently have coaching in place. And that's an additional $18 million to $15 million that already exists. We also have the OEK, or the Optional Enhanced Kindergarten Initiative. And so when TANF funds sunsetted, that initiative, which was formerly about $10.5 million, lost almost $3 million in funding, which funds roughly 35 kindergartens. So if we don't replace that money with something, there's 35 OEK programs that are just going to go away. But in addition to asking for the kind of backfill money to just get to status quo and maintain the programs that exist, there's also an ask for expanded monetary resources in order to empower LEAs to have more OEK experiences for kindergartners going forward. So what we see with KEEP assessments, students coming into kindergarten, about 60% are school ready and about 40% are not. And so this initiative is targeting those 40% that are not demonstrating school readiness within the kindergarten school year. And then the Early Childhood Grant, the final ask on the right side of this sheet, is targeting that. So we want to reduce the 40% within kindergarten, so when they get to the KEEP assessment at the end of kindergarten, they're ready for first grade. This preschool ask is to try to reduce that 40% to begin with by providing more money, or in this case, it's actually just maintaining funds, because again, with TANF sunsetting, we're seeing a lot of the money that's going to preschool from those sources go away. And so we're asking for an additional $3 million to backfill. This is just maintenance. It's not expanding programs beyond what already exists within this space. So early learning is not my specialty. I'm happy to try to field questions. if you have deep questions, there is contact information on the back of this sheet in the lower right-hand corner associated with each of those three asks. And again, this goes without saying, but I'll just mention, in each of these cases, this money is targeting students that are not school ready, which overlaps heavily, as you can imagine, with students that have experienced intergenerational poverty and or come from socioeconomically disadvantaged backgrounds. And so that you can see some explanations within this, but the lion's share of this money is going to support students that are currently don't have enough supports to achieve at the levels that all our students
are getting. I'm just going to ask Tracy to provide her analysis on the three budget requests for the commission members and the advisory committee.
Sure. So for the professional development request, the first one that you got the analysis on, and it has always been the practice of the commission and advisory, is if something's not in the governor's budget, the commission and advisory can evaluate whether or not it's going to support with the recognition that it's not going to be pushing for funding that's not in the governor's budget, and USBE is aware of that. So for the professional development request, it's limited to preschool. So in terms of the additional public preschool, in terms of the additional information, there was just recognition of the fact that they might want to consider including this with private child care, which also has been childhood professionals who are trying to get kids kindergarten ready. So that was raised, and then also just recognition that the Governor's Early Childhood Commission has established a professional development work group around early childhood educators, and just contemplation for the commission and advisory of whether or not that should also be something pursued in the Governor's Early Childhood Commission. OEK, the Optional Enhanced Kindergarten, was included in the Governor's budget, and it's been a position of this body to support Optional Enhanced Kindergarten. And the same is true for the preschool funding, which although it was not included in the Governor's budget, the additional $3 million, it is something that the Commission, policy-wise, to ensure that children experiencing intergenerational poverty have access to high quality preschool, that would be a policy generally that this commission has supported, while recognizing that it's not included in the governor's budget. So that's those three analyses, which I typically do when there's a legislative or budget request for the body.
Any questions for Tracy? We need to take a vote, or we don't have a quorum, so we're not going to have a quorum. So I guess you can go back to Superintendent Dixon, right? Tell her we'll support the one that's in the governor's budget. Policy-wise, we support the other two, but you're going to have to convince the legislature to support this.
Cool. So. I can do that. So my contact information is at the end of the slideshow. If you want to go one more, that's really hard to see, sorry. It's my name at schools.utah.gov. And then contact for early learning if you have any questions about what the programs look like around here. Thanks so much for the opportunity to come down. It's both a
great presentation, Nathan. Thank you. Good enough. Very good. I'll see you. Okay, well. Tracy's up next. We're on agenda item number two, right? Three. So we're going to turn that to Tracy for an overview of the presentation.
I will also be very quick on this. This is in tab three in your binders. There's a summary that was included in the annual report that was released after your last meeting, which was August 13th. So I thought it would be beneficial for you all to get the summary. The report itself is pretty dense. So just so you know, inside your binders, there's the summary pages of what all the agencies have done over the last year that align with the commission's 5- and 10-year plan. So in each of those recommendations that are in Utah's plan for a stronger future, which is in the 5- and 10-year plan, you just have an update from each of the agencies on the progress they've made. We thought it was important for the commission and advisory to have that information and be aware of it, given that we are 7 years into this effort and the great progress that's been made. So you can go through it at your own time, and I'm happy to, after you get a chance to review it, answer any questions. But great progress. You can see that many of these recommendations were completed, so it's our objective to maybe revisit the 5- and 10-year plan with new data and new progress and come back to this commission with some additional information.
What do you believe the timing on that should be? An update, a restart?
I would say probably by the time this group comes back together in the summer.
Very good. Any questions for Tracy?
Just commendation. Shepherding many of these programs that have been piloted.
Thank you. I think that all of the commission agencies have done some pretty significant work. I will say that I think in early childhood development and education, we're starting to see some significant progress, as well as in the area of employment and wages. So things are moving in the right direction for sure, and I think sometimes we lose track in the day-to-day of the progress that's been made. So thank you very much, Bishop Burton. I appreciate that.
Okay, let's pat ourselves on the back for a minute, right? We're doing good stuff. It's been a very interesting journey. We're going to turn to Nuna Phillips. She's going to give us a report on the long-term research agenda for intergenerational poverty. So,
thank you. I'll just do a brief overview, and then we're going to hand over the time to folks on the phone, and then I'll also do some of the presentation. So it'll be a mix of us for this next agenda item. So I want to just give an update to the commission on the activities of the IGP research subcommittee. So that group has been meeting since the summer, and we have we met just a couple of days ago to share out draft research proposals. As all of you recall, in the 2019 annual report, that was the first time that we've had a subsection that is dedicated to agency research proposals, and there were presentations a couple of meetings ago on that item. And so this year we've been having conversations about what are the agency research objectives going to be, and we had a really great discussion at our meeting a couple of days ago. And so You'll be hearing about the draft proposals today, just an overview, and then people will have an opportunity to kind of shape those, and then in February, we as a research subcommittee will be meeting again to finalize those, and then people will get to work so that we have that section of the report ready to go in time for the fall. Before we do the report out, I also want to share that we are having some really exciting conversations about how we can do some more sophisticated long-term analysis on our IGP folks. And so we are forming sort of an interested subgroup that we're calling the 2023 IGP work group. We haven't come up with a snazzy name yet, so that's what our working name is right now. Yeah, good enough. And this is really exciting because what it will allow us to do is to have data going into the Utah Data Research Center that will be able to give us a more comprehensive look at what are the path dependencies to IGP, so what are the factors leading it up to it for families, and then what are some of those things that help get them off the path. So we're in the very early stages of those conversations, but you'll probably be hearing more about that over the coming year or two, and we're hoping to have all of that in place to start having that research come out in 2023. So it's very exciting. Any questions before we shift back to agency proposals for our 2020 IGP annual report? All right. I know that we have some people from the agencies on the phone. Some people are still frantically trying to get in due to our technical issues. So is anybody on the line from the Utah State Board of Education? I know they had a time constraint and wanted to go first. Malia or Wynn, are you able to join us and speak to your proposal?
Yeah.
We are having a really hard time. Really hard timely hearing you. We're having some audio difficulties.
Did you call in with the cell phone?
Yeah, the cell phone.
And I can why don't you just, I think you're going to have to do it. I think you're going to have to summarize everybody. So I apologize to the research folks that joined by phone. We're having audio difficulties, and just for the sake of time, I think I will just give a very brief report out, and then hopefully next time.
So we are very sorry, but we can't, not only can you not hear us, but we can't really hear you. So Nuna is, we're apologizing, but Nuna is going to summarize all of the agency studies that were discussed on Tuesday so that the commission and the committee can actually hear what they were. And we're just very, very sorry that we're having so many technical challenges with this setup today. So we're just going to turn the time over to Nuna, and she's going to summarize each agency's research for the committee's benefit. And Nuna, I would just ask that you come to the phone so they can hear you, because that speaker is not working either.
Okay, I apologize everyone on the phone. I am not a researcher and do not pretend to be, so I hope I can field all of your questions, and if not, I'm happy to jot them down, take them back to the agency, and come back next time. So I'm going to start with the DWS research proposal. So last year, DWS did a really broad look at the 2013 cohort to see what are the demographics, what has sort of happened to all of these individuals over time in a few different domains. And the research proposal this year is to really do a deep dive into the labor force attachment data that we have, because that's all housed at Department of Workforce Services. It's really unique to our agency. And so we'll be taking a look at the cohort over time with factors around employer attachment, workforce attachment on a quarter-by-quarter basis, as well as industry attachment and annual wage growth. So that'll really be, like I said, a deep dive into that labor force, workforce aspect that will give us some more rich understanding of where folks are during this really kind of booming time in our economy. So I think that'll be really exciting to see. So that is the DWS proposal. The Utah System of Technical Colleges has a really exciting proposal to look at the duration and outcomes, graduation rates
in their technical college system for IGP individuals as well as non-IGP individuals. So we'll be able to understand whether or not it takes them longer to complete, what their rates are of completing their technical college career, and to understand how those two compare. So that'll be really exciting. We did not have the Utah Technical College System as part of the agency report out last year, so that'll be another new dimension. The Utah State Board of Education had a few really great proposals, and where they are now is we're focusing in on basically looking at the entire menu of programs and services and interventions that are offered through the Utah State Board of Education, whether it be optional extended day kindergarten or those kinds of things that you heard from Nate earlier in the meeting, and to look at the different touch points for IGP families so that we can start understanding if any one of those particular interventions or services has more of an effect for IGP families. So that's very exciting. And like I said, these are all in draft form, and so it's possible that some of these things will shift a little bit once people start looking at their data and coming together next month, but this is sort of where we are now. The Utah Department of Health has a really exciting proposal to really hone in on low birth weight among children in Utah and looking at IGP families, low-income families that are maybe not IGP, and comparing that against the general population so we can really understand that particular set of families. And we know that poverty often has a real direct relation to low birth weight, and so that's going to be very important for us to understand. And just make sure I'm not skipping anyone. That's Department of Health. And the last one is the Department of Human Services, which has done a lot of work to think about how they can look across many divisions within the Department of Human Services. And so they are looking at the Department of Child and Family Services, Mental Health Services, Juvenile Justice Services, to do something similar to what USBE is doing, and really to understand when a family comes in for any one of these services, how many of the other services are they using across all Department of Human Services programs. And so I think that will be an interesting story, and we'll really be able to better understand how families kind of weave through that agency's services. So that's kind of where we are, and I imagine that in a few meetings we'll be able to come back and actually report out the results, and we'll of course have that as a section of the IGP annual report. And I think conversations will continue to happen within each agency and leadership and their representatives on the research subcommittee to figure out if maybe one of these proposals needs to be shifted a little bit, maybe expanded a little bit, maybe narrowed given what data they're looking at. But we're really excited, and I think last year was a really great sort of kickstart to doing these agency reports, and they're only going to get more intense and give us a better understanding of these families and where they've come across all of these years. So again, apologies, I'm not a researcher, so I might have butchered some of those very technical points, but does anybody have any questions that I can answer?
I think what's important about this next phase in our research is that for many years, the annual report was focused more on like correlations, kind of what are the attributes of these families and where are the gaps. The next phase of the research is really trying to figure out potentially some of the causes, and if there's something that happens at a point in time for a family, either in any of our governmental agencies, that has changed the direction, the trajectory. And it's exciting for us and for the other agencies to really start to hone in on that, so that that then allows this commission and the committee to come up with even further strategies and policies. If we know that one thing is working really, really well and you can isolate that, how do you then make sure that families are attached to that type of service? So that's the next phase of the research. Last year was the first foray into that, and it was great. The agencies did an excellent job, and now we're just building on that. Yeah.
My only request would be to be, potentially, if it's not already thought through in terms of the specificity of the data, meaning geographically located. So if there's some information, I'd love to know, if we can, by municipality, by county, by, right? So
Yeah, I think that's probably not going to happen in the next report, but I think it's something, with all of the county work that's taking place, I think, you know, when we do that county dashboard on our page, as time goes on, we would hope that some of that would become a little bit more sophisticated in some ways, and probably provide a little bit more information. And we will definitely, I mean, to the extent they can hear us, we'll definitely share that at the next research subcommittee meeting.
Well, what would be the problem of breaking it down by county? Some of the important metrics.
Some of the data, it just isn't, it depends on the agency and what information they have to analyze, if they've got the geographic information on the families. It just depends on each agency, and I don't want to speak on their behalf as to whether or not they can break it down that way.
I'll certainly take that back and see if we can maybe think about incorporating that into future years if we can't do that this year.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, obviously, on a basis, I would love to see the data so that we can continue to, you know, see what we need to do from an empirical standpoint. But I also think that it's worth, from a structural standpoint, to have a subcommittee of counties that I think it would be really interesting to have their take as you start to get county-level data from the research committee. It'd be an interesting conversation to have the counties respond back to, oh, that makes sense, or I would have never known that, or right, so there might be some rich conversation as the studies are being conducted even to get some county level response. So I think it would be an interesting conversation.
That's it for me.
Yeah, let's go to item 5, should we? TJ, do you want to handle it in John's absence?
You gotcha. So, with regards to the county efforts and the grants that they received, there's been a lot of success that we're seeing from the counties. And so we asked three of the counties to make a presentation of what they're doing and what they're seeing. And so we've asked Weber County, Washington County, and Carbon County to do some presentations on their plans. Unfortunately, because of the technology, Carbon County won't be able to do that presentation. So we'll just listen to Weber County and Washington County, and we'll have Weber County go first.
Do you understand?
Yeah. You probably should go close to the phone.
Okay.
So they're having problems hearing us.
Okay.
And then, do you want me to hold it? Here's your
thank you very much. Great. Well, thank you for the invitation. My name is Melissa Friedang. I'm from Weber County. I'm here with Commissioner Scott Jenkins, and we're super excited to talk about our plan. So I'm going to dive right in. I'm happy to entertain any questions along the way, so please interrupt me and just ask away if I'm not being clear or if you want me to deep dive. I'm going to go very quickly. I've been asked to finish inside of 10 minutes. And anybody who knows me knows that I can talk for an hour or more. So I'll try to go very, very fast.
We'll take the 10-minute version this time.
Understood. So in order to understand our plan, it's really important to understand what we've done in Weber County. The Weber Center Prosperity Center of Excellence is an interagency agreement between our Weber Human Services, which is our public behavioral health, our Weber Morgan Health Department, which is our public health department, and the Weber County Commissioners. So really what we're looking at, and I'm not going to read this slide, you can see what the goals are for the center. But we're really focused on these four areas right now. We certainly are flexible enough because our goals are really to decrease duplication in our county, to take a systems level approach and really look at the terms of community resilience and family resilience for all our Weber County families. So with that, you can see the history of our intergenerational poverty approach. You all probably know this already, but just as an overview, you can see that in 2016, when Lieutenant Governor Cox came and kicked off the big campaign, we actually created our own Welfare Reform Commission and our Intergenerational Poverty Commission. So we mirrored the state's infrastructure in terms of how we were approaching this. In 2017, we wrote the plan. our county plan, and then in 2018, we applied for the grant dollars and started implementing. In 2019, because we went to the commissioners and the executive director of the health department and Labor Human Services, we wanted to make sure that as commissioners changed and as other executive directors changed, we wanted to look at intergenerational poverty from a generational timeline perspective. So rather than look at these by grants or look at or do this work in this way where we're dependent on the funding stream, the commissioners and the executive directors decided to really put in this 20, 40, 50 long-term approach so that this intergenerational poverty initiative could have lots of sustainability. So with that, we launched the Prosperity Center of Excellence, and then in 2020, our goal is to replicate and scale the model. And we did, just as a side note, we did close down our Intergenerational Poverty Advisory Committee because we launched the Prosperity Center of Excellence. There's multiple meetings going on in our community where we're all showing up to the same meetings that are just at a different place. So one of the things that deduplicate did change that and not to duplicate was to close that down, even though the work is still continuing on for a longer term. Whichever you have, and it's not clicking.
Can you advance it?
Thank you. You also have a packet in front of you if you'd like to see that. So some of the initiatives that are happening in our community, some of you are probably very well aware of the Utah Alliance for the Social Determinants of Health. They're doing work at two zip codes within Ogden. We also have the Ogden United Promise Neighborhood, which has shifted into the United Partnership Council by the United Way of Northern Utah. And then we have the Ogden Civic Action Network that's being run through Weber State University. So I provided this map to show you that our target population is that little green dot there. It's a 10 by 10 block area, and that has 4,500 residents that are in extreme poverty in that little intersection. So it's not that each one of us are doing our own thing. It's that we're all aligned, and our ICANN population, our 35 families, are from that particular subsection so that we can, all of these meetings that we're all attending, we can all make sure that we're working together towards the same end. So, we're really happy to have the Alliance work there too. So, wherever there was something being done that we didn't have to take on as a center of excellence, we then support. So on all of those, I'm on the steering committee, and our commissioners are involved in each one of those types of advisory committees so that we're understanding what's happening at the boots on the ground level. In fact, our we've been working health department executive directors chairing the Alliance work right now. So we're heavily, heavily involved in all of these initiatives so that we're not deduplicating. So what is the ICANN model? So our mission is to create a community where all children can exercise the power of self-determination. So that's for all children, not just those experiencing poverty. So the top three things that we wanted to figure out in terms of this innovation and implementation grant was to really hit the community accountability, so deduplicating, creating a system where everybody could plug in if they had service. So we took a child-centric approach with two generational strategies. This is a socio-ecological model, and so what we've done is really looked at what did that child need. We have 35 families. That's equaled 94 individuals that we're serving. So even if a child is 9 months old, we're serving that child. So the child is the main focus, with understanding that parents create these opportunities and environments for the children to be successful. And then we're looking at family resilience, and we're looking at indicators of child health and well-being that match directly to DWS's indicators. So we want to make sure that we're aligning all the time vertically, whether it's state, county, municipality, or even agency level. So the resource integration coach is essentially an increase in social capital for our families, because we know that there's a gap. So our resource integration coach will access the educational FYA. The FYA is a family youth advocate paid for by SB 67. They find children who are struggling academically. They'll do home visits. They'll do case management around that young person, for example, So if our intergenerational poverty child is experiencing academic achievement issues and they're not covered by an FYA, we can call the school and say, can we get this young person connected to your FYA? So that young person, the resource integration coach, isn't the expert on education. We have a direct contact to pick up the phone immediately to get that contact to that agency to make sure that that child gets what that agency has to offer. So we'll do that in education, we do that in DWS. We have one DWS worker, Libby, who did NextGen Kids. She's phenomenal. So if we have a family that needs DWS access, she makes sure that those families have exactly what they need, so we don't have to be the DWS expert. Same with health, same with mental health, which is absolutely gigantic for everybody in our population. Mental health is a huge issue. So if you look at this model, if you look at the child, it's a child-centric approach. The interpersonal is another big piece, so it's not just their families, it's their peers. And it's also where we think we can create these meaningful adult relationships. So if we can get children in these recreational pursuits, they might have access to more coaches. If we can get them stabilized in a neighborhood, they can connect with the coaches in that community, can take them on. So the idea is in every environment where they are, if we can give them opportunities to have meaningful adult relationships, if their parents, right, or beyond their parents, we know that that's going to make that child successful. We can't control that. We can't pair an adult to a child, right? It has to happen very naturally. But if we're trauma-informed in all of the areas that we're working in, including all of the institutions that, which we have, by the way, 500-plus nonprofits in Weaver County. So that's a lot of nonprofits doing a lot of great work, but some of them have eligibility issues, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, we wanted to build a system where everybody could plug in. So with that said, this is how it works. We have students that were outreached to, and really what we did is to find our 35 families, we had all of our prime agencies on our implementation team refer families to us. So we had WIC referring families to us to get the 0 to 2-year-olds. We had Ogden School District referring families to us. We had ALCAP and the Circles Program referring people to us. So we have lots of people in need, but we wanted to make sure to really interact with our implementation team to find those families where we really wanted to test this model. We didn't want to cream or just to have people who might otherwise be successful. And then what we do is we ask the families to ask themselves, what do I need? We call those WINS, W-I-N-S. And then we track the WINS, and they can be short-term WINS, like, did you do research and find the 5 years child care within a 10-mile radius so that you can go to work? Or big WINS, like, I got my high school diploma, right? So WINS are whatever that family defines, and so we do customize for every single person inside of that family, and I'll show you that in just a minute. It's pretty exciting. But we do track the WINS, and then the way that turned out didn't turn out how it's printed, so you're not supposed to see a little arrow. It looks way better than that. But the idea is that you monitor WINS results. Depending on where they at, you go back to the measure of family resilience, see where they're at, and then reset the plan. So it's this continual loop until they're truly, truly self-sufficient. So mobilize and unify service providers, that was the number one goal. Increase family resilience was a very important goal, but kind of number two, because we wanted to see if we could create this environment where everybody could plug in terms of the system. And then number three was certainly to increase the children's capacity to exercise self-determination. So if you look at your little packets, or big packets, all the way in the back, you'll see this is how you measure family resilience. So the front page is a profile where we're aggregating all the information. It's a measurement packet. And if you look in the back, this measurement packet consists of the evidence-based Arizona measure of self-sufficiency. So we wanted to, as much as possible, use every evidence-based practice we could find. And you can read through those. Those are pretty in-depth. And we scored on a scale of 1 to 5, of Likert scale, so that we can come up with a very consistent way to measure among our resource integration coaches. Then we have housing measures, housing affordability, stability, and quality. Which are very different measurements. So we're looking at those. We also have a community measure that we do use, but But because these families are all from the same neighborhood, we didn't have that calculated into this yet. But those would be things like access to schools, walkability, safety, air quality, etc. And then if you look at the last score, we have employability skills. We also have employment barriers that we minus off this score. So it's a pretty intensive measurement score that comes down to one score, which is, if you look at this document, these are all of our measurements and our outcomes. This is probably the most important outcome that you can see. On the very, very back is our family resilience score. We have moved from an average of 53.5 out of 100 in terms of family resilience to 73.25. And this is our three-quarter mark. So after 9 months of work, we've made our families pretty significantly. But you can also see that we've kept all the indicators of child health and well-being that we report on a quarterly basis to TJ. We, as an implementation team, went through and measured this on a monthly basis with our team, which Commissioner Jenkins chaired. So heavily involved, really looking at how we're doing this. If you look at this, what surprised us, this surprised us that every single measure went up. It surprised us by how much. So as you stabilize, and we're working, six of our families were homeless when they came to us. So, you know, now what we're doing is not only pulling in these service providers that do human services, we're literally pulling in service providers that are doing housing services and homeless services, and they're two different sectors. So we're really proud of this work in particular. Again, we've really focused on the children. For example, we have a mother who is schizophrenic and not on her meds and living out of her car that got pounded, but anyway. We're not going to change her outcome. We can't find her. But she has four children. All four children are housed. They have a guardian. And we've connected them to CCFS and the system of care. And right, so all of these really great services that already exist, we're making sure that these children have all of the community wrapped around them. So that measure of family resilience, when you look at the literacy levels and the numeracy levels, and you look at the after-school program, 100% now, when USB was up here talking about do they have access to it, do they know about it, our resource integration coaches are making sure to connect with the schools so that the LEAs can get the students involved in all of the programs that we know are working and why they have those programs. With that said, no presentation will be complete without...
Can you ask me one more slide?
Sorry, two more slides. So we're really excited about this because we created a system where our partners can plug in. So Western Governors, for example, have offered free ride scholarships to any of our participants that want that. They're very interested in solving this intergenerational poverty problem. So it's not just that they're offering money. They're also, they have a cutting leadership, and they're asking for our input for their student services to make sure that we develop these skills for our intergenerational poverty families so that they're successful. So it's not just, hey, we'll give you a free ride. We have Western Governors coming to us saying, look, we understand that this is an issue, and we want to make sure that we're providing an infrastructure that makes this population successful. So it truly is a partnership. We also have the Rocky Mountain Home Fund Initiative. This is Representative Steve Waldrop, his day job. And the idea here is it's a pathway to home ownership. So once you get a family that's resilient and they have employment, it's typically the families that are unbankable. And what they do is they go in and they share, essentially, the cost of a property. It's a low-interest loan. The families are backed, and then the families are building assets to the principal that they're paying on it, which is on a sliding scale up to 30% AMI. So it's very similar to sort of the Section 8 idea of being able to afford that, but it's in the private world. So we're super excited about that partnership, and we'll be moving a lot of our families into home ownership eventually. The idea is that they have to build up 6 months of savings to make sure that if the furnace goes out or something happens, that they can make make sure their house is up and moving. But they also can take that money. They can either buy the house outright when they're ready, when they have enough principal down, or they can take that principal, which is their savings, their assets, and they can go out of another home and move in, and then they're more able to become homeowners. So we're really excited about that program. The other problems that we're addressing are housing stock. We have an affordable housing passport that we're looking at. We're really looking at homelessness. We have a huge increase, 66% increase in our homelessness population. It's growing exponentially. We're trying to attack that. And then our mental health. Mental health is a root cause. And we're trying to make sure that we're really doing these upstream social determinants of health. And then we want to replicate and scale the model. We're super excited about what we found works. It's working, and so we have the data to prove that. So no presentation would be complete unless you have a success story. So I'd like to share Wendy is our success story for today. And she'd moved from a 54 family resilience into a 91. So she was a victim of domestic violence. She has four children. One has a significant disability. And what we've done for her is just give it. She was working three jobs. She was basically homeless when she came to us. And she now has a job with the IRS. She's got three promotions. And she will be, she's enrolled in WGU, which is super fun. And then she will be our first Recommend Homes person. So inside of 12 months, you have a family. It's pretty significant. So, again, I mean, not every single one. Our wins are different for our different families. We have one family that have both parents incarcerated at different times. So stabilizing those children and just getting access to the children is a win in that situation and making sure that we're decreasing student school absenteeism. So not everybody's going to be a homeowner, but every single person has risen in terms of the indicators of child health and well-being. So with that, I will entertain.
I just, I'm blown away.
Awesome.
Yeah. Awesome.
It's fun.
Congratulations. Yeah, thank you. Questions? Thank anybody has? I think you answered all of mine and some I didn't know.
With 35 families, what do you think about scaling up? Is there a capacity? How would your approach change if the number were 100?
So we wouldn't change the approach. Really what we would do is just a case management sort of outcome ratio. So we have two resource integration coaches with 35 families, which is about 94 people. So really what we would do is just scale to that model. But every agency, the beauty of this from a community perspective is that if you have a legislator who, Senator Milner said to us, to the homeless services in a different meeting, she said, we have tons of money coming into your county, right? You're not getting more money. Do better with your money. I paraphrase. Sorry, don't quote me on that. I probably didn't represent her. No, I
didn't. That's a direct quote.
You guys know her. You know her. She'd laugh if she was in the room. Anyway, my point is what this does is take all the existing resources and all the existing subject matter expertise and roll that all together. So we probably will find other things and other gaps as we move to 100 for sure, but the way this works is we now can see the gaps. Yeah. So whenever we have a gap, we find an innovation for that gap. And we have what we call integrated partnerships and resources. So in education, we bring all the services in education around just the families. And we say, this is what we're seeing. So for example, there was a gap in parenting skills. So what we did is we got with Parents Empowered and we got with the schools and said, okay, so what are you teaching in SEL, which is the social emotional learning and resiliency? And we test with the DESA, Zebro, whatever that stands for. Then in the after school program, they were doing the same SEL, but just in a different environment with different people. So we built a curriculum for our parents to then do that same curriculum so that this child is getting school, after school, and home environment, really consistent messages.
It sounds like the Circles program, just a little more teeth. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Circles program, you kind of ask these mentors to kind of do this thing, but you need teeth, it sounds like. I just wonder, how can Utah County do this? You know what I mean? Like, how would you transport that? Who needs to be at the table?
Well, I think the beauty, I mean, we are lucky, and huge kudos to our commissioners because they're taking an economic view of this. It is economic development, so they created a center of excellence where we can be Switzerland, and we can be a hub where, at the county level, I refer directly to the commissioners. So I'm able to look at the entire community. So the center of excellence, I don't think you have to have a center of excellence. You can do it through the health department or through an agency, but...
But it structures it in a way that's different.
Yeah, and it solves the wrong pockets problem. So it allows us to work with all of the agencies and then fill the gaps and get funding for, like, the IGP funding, right, as a county, to then pull this all together. So really at the pattern, at the foot level, this model can, it could easily be implemented in Utah County. And we met with Paiute County yesterday. And they're thinking about, they can apply this to, because we all have the same issues, transportation, mental health, parental engagement. I mean, they're all the same issues, they're just different strategies wherever they're located. So, and it involves everybody in this room, right, each of the agencies and executive directors, to make sure, kind of what they're studying for DHS, for example, how do we get all of those services wrapped around that one particular family, resource integration code, this is social capital. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I like that model, though, because you're right about the, you know, if this is the health department has a thousand other things, too. It's not their core mission. And inevitably, it's, well, that's the health department. They do their thing. You know, you run into the silos, and you know, I don't know.
Well, and this truly is upstream social determinants of health.
Yeah.
No one's doing this. So to me, IGP is upstream social determinants of health. We have lots of data now around social determinants, but how do you do upstream? So that's part of what the Center of Excellence is really looking at, SHARP data, right? We're looking at substance abuse, we're looking at depression, we're looking at suicide, we're looking at, right? And we're impacting all of those so much earlier on, right? We're hoping that in 5 to 10 years, you'll see our numbers go significantly down. So the Surgeon General, just as a quick thing, he's now pushing for the CHEP program, which is Community Health and Economic Prosperity. So these are all intertwined, but we're very lucky, again, to have a center of excellence where we can start looking at these things.
No, it may be the most important thing that's happening in the state, honestly. So, congratulations.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
I'm very excited about what I'm hearing. One is the outreach. How did you target the families and convince them to get engaged, because we've always struggled with that. There's different things that we've tried. So what's been the best techniques you've used to get them to agree to work with us?
Well, we're really truthful with them. We say, this is what we're going to expect from you. So if you want to participate, because if they don't want to participate, right, we can't. So we do take a couple of times where we talk to them, and we don't have any eligibility requirements.
So go back even further, though.
Yeah.
Go further upstream.
Okay. Like,
you started with talking to them. How do you find them? How do you get them in for that first conversation?
So first batch of families came through. There was a big Christmas sub for Santa. And so we went to the sub for Santa. And really what it is based on a trust relationship within each of the partnering agencies. So trust is a major factor. It's the absolute for the resource integration.
So you started with a group, a nonprofit that had the relationship.
Multiple nonprofits that had the relationship. Yeah. So we have families from circles. We have families from here. So our Ogden School District wants 7th graders. There's not a lot of services around 7th graders, which is a really important group. So they have educational dollars. They have a grant that's Gear Up, IGP grant. So she said, I want some of our Gear Up kids to be a part of this. So it really was a community-wide, how do we refer families where we have all of these dollars going towards IGP, right, but in these sectors. So that was part of the conversation with all of our partners. Yes, ma'am.
Were you able to incentivize the families to get their buy-in and participation? Was that anything that you were able to do?
No, we don't believe in incentivizing families to do that.
Okay.
The incentive should be that they can grow and they don't have to live in this and experience what they're experiencing.
Yeah, I just wondered if you had some short-term ones.
No. Really what happens is when you get those short-term wins, it creates a growth mindset. And once you get those little bits, then they finally see light at the end of the tunnel, and they know they have a trusted relationship, and they can text our resource integration coaches. And right, they, at first, it's, oh my gosh, this happened, or this, right? And the coach is like, well, you have a flat tire, or somebody called you to come pick them up because they have a flat tire. Don't go. You're employed. So, but the number one cultural value of these families is loyalty. They are loyal to each other. If anything else, they'll give their last dollar for each other, but a lot of times those behaviors keep them in poverty. So it's really providing them the dignity to have their own values and tell them not to change and join our middle class values, but still help them with some of those behaviors and skill sets so they understand what the repercussions are of their decision.
I just want to say a couple things here. We had a few months ago a gal that appeared on TV on the news, and she says, I'm down at the Lantern House and I can't get the services I need. Well, she'd given the interview, but before she appeared on TV, she showed up in our commission meeting a couple days later, and she says, I was sent here from Kearns because they don't have the services, and told me to go to Weaver County. So she came up and stood in right in front of us and said, I need help. Well, before we were out of the meeting, Melissa contacted her because she was sitting in the back of the room and started the enrolling process already that fast. And so she onboarded her, and she's in our program today with her children.
She's a November ad, a late November ad, so we have only had a few weeks to work with her. But we struggle because she has seven children, single mom. So a lot of the Section 8 and the housing, there's no options for her. Even if she was at that, we have a two-year waiting list and a five-year waiting list for another program. So there's just not enough. Even though we might have great systems and interventions, there's just not enough to solve the problems that we're dealing with. So even all of our nonprofits, we went to everyone.
So there's two other things, John, I want to mention here. One is the gap analysis. So we're in the middle of finishing that right now. So we had started a task force to look where our deficits were, where we were not filling in. Well, in the meantime, the gap analysis came up and required us to do that. So it's kind of doing the same thing now. But we're getting into that and finding out where the gaps in our community lie. And we also have hired a coordinator, somebody specifically to coordinate the LHCC and all the nonprofits in our community. That person is employed and works for Melissa. And we're in the middle of that right now. So we're well along the way of putting this together. But it's a little complicated.
We're trying to merge and align our IGP work, our homelessness work, our housing work.
They're all interconnected. That's the truth. That's what we need. That's been the problem all along. For 40 years, we've had all these different things, and nobody's put them together.
You know, the requirements now that require us and ask us to do this, we understand the purpose behind it. It's very easy to see that. But we don't want to offend our nonprofits out there, because really, you can't replace them. So our goal, of course, is to hopefully we can find out where our gaps are and get some of the nonprofits to move into those areas and others not.
Especially where there's some overlap.
Yeah. And we think we'll be able to do that when we get this gap analysis. And of course, that's due at the end of the month. So we're anxious to get that finished.
Thanks, Commissioner.
One final question. How have you overcome the bureaucracy and the privacy issues that we tend to get wrapped around the spokes on?
Yep. When we onboard them, we do the 115, and then we also ask them specifically, we say, can we share your name with? So it's a litany of, it's a list. And then if there's someone new that comes on board, we'll ask them directly and then have a new. So we have to do it sort of the long way around. But
you have that relationship, so they feel like that's going to be helpful for them.
Yeah. And anytime you explain to them, they can revoke it. We don't right? They don't have to just sign up. So sometimes they'll say yes to this one and yes to that one, but then over time, once the relationship's built, it doesn't like it because they see it working and they can trust it. So the trust is the big piece. And we also have other agencies. So we work with UTA to figure out the transportation issue, right? We lease the van from UTA where we can drive the participants and the children's places that they need to go. We don't drive them to work every day. But if they're short-term needs, we also have a partnership with them to do a community van pool, essentially. So lots of ways to plug anybody in that has a service. Sorry about the time.
No, John, one more comment.
Sure.
It's been interesting to watch Melissa work because so much of the barriers that people feel are simply getting into the system and being part of it. They can't navigate it, they feel uncomfortable about it. So her and I were sitting at Workforce Services this morning waiting to get into a meeting. Well, we were just sitting in a chair at tables like this. And this older gentleman walked in the room. And, we have no idea what he was there for, but, well, we do know, because he went in and talked to somebody later on. So as he went up to talk to somebody, they come out and give him a sheet of paper and said, answer those five questions right there. And we sat and watched him. And he looked at it, and he got his glasses out, and he tried to figure out what to do. And I kind of looked over at Melissa, and she said, see what I mean? It's hard to do. And eventually they took him in and they got it all took place. I don't want to be critical here. But when we watch these people try to get through the system, it's just about an impossible thing. And these resource integration coaches, they get involved in these people's lives. And of course they know everybody. So when they walk into the room, I have these people and this is what they need. And they come over and say, okay, let's help you. And it's done like that. And they go from win to win to win to win. And without the resource integration coach, they get one thing done and go home and say, oh, I'm done. I'm never going to go do that again. And they just don't go back and do anything else.
That's a law degree, and I don't think I can do that.
Yeah.
Well, we have technology now. You get a hotspot to them. But you need a McDonald's so their kids can play.
Exactly.
Right? So like Marlon Jensen was the chair of our advisory committee, and he said it best, I think, one by one.
Yeah, there's no more that little bit said this. You can't. You got to get out from behind the desk and meet them where they are.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Thank you. Well done.
Thank you.
Washington County.
Okay. I don't know if they're going to be able to hear me or not.
You don't know what's going on.
Yeah. I'll stand closer. I'm going to come at this angle. Thank you for having us today. I think it's really rewarding to actually see how other counties are rolling pilot programs out. It's fascinating because it's a big, diverse state that we live in. And here locally, we live in urban rural. We're urbanizing here in the metro area. But my name is Charmaine Gold, and I've been working with TJ and Tracy for the last year. Specifically what I'm going to present on today. My role with Washington County is I'm the Program Director of Court Support Services. I also came on a board about 2017, and I was asked to sit on the IGP committee. And we have a very robust IGP committee with all the major four pillars. And so we all have subcommittees that have our tasks and our takeaway projects. I sit on all four of them because of what I particularly do in the justice system. And let me explain that a little bit so it might give a backstory of where we targeted our pilot program. When we went into collaboration, as we always do, we were serving the same population, of course. And with the socioeconomic factors, we went into discussion. And one extra layer that we realized with all these factors is they could be tied to the justice system, which makes them a little bit more harder to achieve a success rate, be it housing support, employment services. It limits them additionally, especially when they're active in their court case without it being resolved. So what we decided to do was focus on the adult system. It also encompasses all of the other pillars with that because their family is attached to somebody that's committed a crime. So our county plan is not, I'm speaking specifically of our pilot program, not of our county IGP plan, because we want to line that up with exactly that and come together as a collective group. Our education and mentoring program across generations, we wanted to target higher education because we've been in operation since 2017, so we've seen a large pool of people that were very indigent, low income, unemployed, and a medium high education level, which was very surprising for all lawmakers on a county level.
Sure, but, yes. Just so you'd appreciate, this is a justice reinvestment population here.
Yes. So when we went into development in 2017, we realized that the impoverished population in the criminal justice system ties everything together with behavioral health, public health, education, in addition to public safety, our corrections, our courtrooms. I mean, it really is everybody involved, an entire person. With the education program that we're going to eventually get to, we started with very basic minimal goal. How are we going to roll this out? Develop and implement a higher education program. We have great partners to do that. Department of Workforce Services, City Technical College is one of our major partners, in addition to four-year institutions. When somebody wants to go into an education, we don't limit them to where it's going to be here on a local level. We cater to them in the entire state, sometimes four-year college degrees in addition to tech trade programs. What their specific goals are in mind is targeted at the very beginning. We know that with increasing their education, what happens is they are connected to career pathways. Then that increases their income, and it stabilizes their home, and it teaches the next generation that they are able to advance through the socioeconomic class. Our third goal is to reduce those barriers of increasing success. When you have an individual that's homeless, basically no insurance and access to or something that's going to prevent them from even getting to treatment services or their doctor because they have no transportation, every one of those things along the way we realized is a barrier for them. We did a poverty simulator with five counties associations of government, and I actually participated in that myself, and I failed. I did not make it through and pay my utilities in time and pick up my child from daycare, and I lost my job. So it was a very difficult thing, and it happened in one day. So I can imagine a lifetime of having to deal with those challenges, something that isn't learned overnight. With that, what we do in the court system with court support services, we have two-phase programs. It's pre- and post-adjudication. So when an individual comes in, they meet with a licensed clinical social worker, and they're a series of evaluations performed with their criminal risk and needs assessment in addition to a full biopsychosocial evaluation. We do this at no cost. What we do is we provide information on the individual from everything, from biomedical conditions, mental health, behavioral health, their criminogenic risk factors, their associations. We inform the judge and the defense and prosecutor on that case to make a determination and have more information to implement treatment rather than long incarceration periods, because then again they're removed from their family, their stability, their kids are attached to that. So we've seen a huge increase of advocating and implementing the justice reinvestment as it was supposed to be. When their case was resolved, it could be a difference of any type of court agreement, putting a buyout or sentencing. Generally, education is always tied to that. We let them know where they left off in their education and where their desires and goals are to be. And that's actually now tied with the teeth and the levers of the court case. So that's how we anchor it. With that being said, it takes all partners at the table. We realized that the judges needed to be on board, defense, prosecutors, in addition to behavioral health, local mental health and substance use authorities, private sector. We had to reach out to everybody. When we realized what kind of population are we working with, we knew overall status, but when you implement two generations of poverty, that's different. So with over 565 assessments that we've done in the one-year period, we have realized, and this is just for the justice system, we have realized that 54% result in two generations of poverty. We have comparison data that shows people that are currently in poverty versus ones that are two generations. That's where you see IGP eligible and IGP ineligible. Out of that IGP ineligible, 54%, the same exact amount, are currently experiencing 100% federal poverty level. So we hit the target right on the head with a large pool of population that are going to always be underserved. Be it for their mental health issues or be it for their low income, their lack of employment, but they are educated people. What we realized when we pulled a lot of 2 years' worth of data was that 54% of them would have high school education, some college, or a college degree. So we wanted to hit that area and increase and connect to career pathways. Dixie Technical College has that built from within, so we didn't need to create something that was already there. So we guide them, we work with them. So when an individual comes in and they sign a plea in abeyance, first thing they do is they sign a 115 form. I'm not sure what the actual UWF form, which we share that population. Basically, if that individual says, I would like on-the-job training, or we owe a program, it's a shared population at that time. So it's almost like two partners going in to one meeting, and it's very, you know, you can get more done with teamwork than you actually can an individual. When that individual is signing on a plea in advance, he gets an assigned case manager throughout that whole duration of their probation period. So it can be up to 3 years. We follow this person up to 3 years. Based on their success and their performance, we just have this incentive as an education program. You know, it gives them something, but not only are they court agreed to do, but it really kind of ultimately ends in a matter of a conversation that they may have never had before. What do you want to do with the rest of your life? This isn't it. This isn't where you landed. And this isn't where you're going to be. The overall, I do want to, before I move to this slide, I want to tell you, we collect a lot of information. I didn't realize how much of a data geek I really was until we started going, but I wanted to see what poverty levels are we experiencing in the justice system, all the way down from age, gender, residency, are they local, are they transient, what's their marital status, what is their employment, household income size, how many are in the household, in addition to living arrangements. Are they dependently living on others? Are they homeless? Are they chronically homeless? So all the way down to trauma. We realize that in drug of choice, are they an opioid user? We have so many issues with a person that's in poverty that we want to target and understand where our gaps are in the system. If it is rapid resource development, if it's bringing stakeholders together to fight any opioid epidemic, if it's more or less along the lines of, you know, trauma-informed care, which when you do have a licensed clinical social worker in the very beginning of a court case, ask you questions about things that you've experienced as a child that could be the root of a problem that propelled you into, you know, anxiety and depression and the symptom of drug use and substance use that put you in the cycle, we realize that all those questions have to be asked. Progress that we've made. We decided to use our funding for the majority of it, actually a large and a high 90% for all barrier funding to create sustainability. When an individual decides they want to go into education, just the same as I would want to go back to school, I'd have to apply for a Pell Grant or a student loan or something that would be able to pay for my services. Dixie Technical College already had that built from within with an admissions counselor, but they just didn't know how to get there. We didn't know how to actually further that without that partnership intact. With barrier funding, we have served over 233 people with the highest priority of housing, secondary of transportation. We are working on that on a county level with the transportation because we do have outland for areas from Hurricane all the way up to Enterprise. New Harmony as well, that, you know, in Kane County, we're realizing that the population we're serving can be in multiple districts. So we have to be able to ground them into one central place, communicate with the other counties on what we're doing, and then ultimately not result in maybe a warrant of arrest if they didn't go to court in another area. Because there's so many people involved in one specific person, but it takes a case manager to do that. We've absorbed that cost from within our program. We didn't utilize any money for staff. 55% participants in the education program since January of 2019. 39 of them are in higher education. As you can see, 6 have already graduated and 4 in the spring. And summer, those are probably the best days that we get to do our job is when we get to go to the graduation ceremony and recognize the fact that maybe that person didn't even know what they were able to do or what their value was in this world. 16 are in a high school education diploma, which 3 have graduated, 3 more in the spring and summer. We didn't just limit it to court support services as well. It's not just in people that are coming through pre. We've reached out to adult probation and parole. We filter them into the same system. We reached out to drug court, specialty court, mental health court, treatment centers, the local mental health centers, started funneling everybody back into this education program. I cannot take the credit for this result right here. I think we all work together as a team, but the day-to-day boots on the ground is Mr. Jonathan Love. We were very blessed to actually acquire him through the Criminal Justice Education Grant Program, which I partner with the CCJJ on. And he is a full-time personnel staff with a vast amount of experience, knowing he's been in previous practicing law in government as a prosecuting attorney. So he knows that you also have somebody that has a history that may limit them from an education because it could be health and human services and their felony record might dismantle that whole plan of action. So he guides them and structures and gets a lot of their transcripts and tedious work of not only cultivating that change and interview and motivational interviewing, but keeping them on track, asking the question, what are you experiencing? You just lost your housing. Come on in, let's talk about it. Let's get you another place to live. So it's constantly touching that person. 55 people is what he's experienced. But I know, and I'll end with where we're headed in 2020 because I'm really excited about that. I might need more than one Jonathan to do that, but we'll have to see. I'd like to turn the time over to him, though, for the success story. That's his doing.
Okay. Just by way of background, when I came here in April, I didn't have a lot of experience dealing with people in the criminal justice system other than being a prosecuting attorney. These kids were on the other side of the fence. And a lot of them, I just learned they would come in, they'd had tough life circumstances. Like this woman here, she's 19. As she was growing up, her parents got divorced. Her mom became a substance abuser, and her brother was severely autistic. She ended up basically raising the family herself. And when she came to us when she was 18, she ended up hanging out with the wrong people, ended up with a possession charge, and she circled the box saying she was interested in further education. So what I try to do is help all these people navigate all the stuff they don't want to deal with. So she let me get her transcript. I looked at it. She had a 3.6 grade point average, and her ACT scores were in the 95th percentile. And she was working at a car wash. And I told her, are you interested in anything? Her ultimate goal is to be a plastic surgeon. But right now, she's in the medical assistant program here. She's been in it for 7 months. She's doing exceptionally well. She just got hired at BioLife, working in the field that she wants to practice in. And she's doing extremely well. And a lot of this feels like my second home here. I have like 16 clients that are actually enrolled in various programs here now, and they're all doing exceptionally well. The good news about her, she finished probation early. We went to the judge and asked that her plea in abeyance be dismissed, so she doesn't have the record anymore that brought her to us. And that's also what I'm trying to do as a practicing attorney. I want to make sure that they get their cases expunged, or if they have an agreement with the court that says their cases be dismissed, that they get that piece of paper so that that record does not follow them as they go on in life. This is Les He, longtime resident here. His father died at an early age. His brother became addicted to heroin. His mom kind of didn't know how to deal with a lot of the situations. He basically assumed the role of the father. And eventually, he ended up hanging out with the wrong people, ended up with a possession charge as well. And he came to me, and he got his GED in Wyoming. He was extremely smart. He was working in construction. He's in the welding program now, doing exceptionally well. He has 100% participation rate, and he's in the top 2% of the class. He's also going to do an externship at a welding job, which generally is going to hire him when he's done with school. The goal of all these technical things are that the kids, when they're done, they're going to have a job. They're going to have a good wage. And all the things that brought them to us, they don't exist anymore. With Caitlin, the one thing she told me was, everybody at the school's normal. They're nice people. I like them. She hangs out with them on holidays. Obviously, you can see that they're from all walks of life. But it just brings them into a totally different environment than what brought them to us. And the good thing is, with all the resources we have and the ability to have case managers talk to them, we can make sure that they just keep progressing and succeeding. And so it's turned into a really great program, and it's really nice to see these people graduating early and getting employment and eventually thanking us. So thanks.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'd like to end with knowing where we're headed with this, because ultimately when you give this pot of money, it's not forever. One time, create sustainability. So as you can see, we make sure that those conversations are for financing the education, working through any barriers, the conversations of how are you going to pay for this next month, budgeting, changing jobs, getting a second job if necessary, and then also as community and nonprofit agencies, they have additional funds, so we access all resources before we use the barrier funding to do that. We've had such a high success rate, and thank you for Department of Workforce Services. We just received our extension till June of 2020, and what we're deciding to use with the money is it's great to have referrals from the court system in pretrial, and then coming back in from other outside justice agencies and treatment programs. But we have a huge amount that we're not hitting yet. I feel like our community partner, our pillar agencies, are also experiencing the same detriment and the social determinants of health. We have, were implemented before the Alliance, but we are also a zip code of the Alliance project. There is a little bit more narrow than what we are able to reach countywide. So with that, what we've decided to re-amended the grant, and we have asked and developed already and rolled out an implementation to where they can access these dollars as well. So they're going to be doing a lot more assessments. They're going to be targeting what areas, and we're going to study who's the most referring agency that we're getting them from. We collect the same information all the way from age down to trauma rate and what type of trauma. And then we connect them to education. So I am open for any questions that you may have.
Impressive. Good job. Really good. I noticed women in that picture. Breakdown between men and women.
As far as IGP identified as IGP?
No, in the education program, 55 participants there. What's the breakdown of?
You know, that's a great. I could easily get that and send it to you. It's actually a good mix. 55% male, 45% female. Yep. Cool. Yes. But what they're graduating in is what they really want to do. So it's CNC machinery, which is laser technology, diesel mechanics. These jobs and these industries are going to be landing them at 60,000 or higher pay at the end of it. So even if their household size is 1 to 4 or 7 children, they're going to be able to have that sustainable income.
Any other questions?
Hi.
Oh, one more.
So these are kids, I think, that are articulating that they need help. Do you have a sense for kids that may not be completely there yet, recognizing that?
We've gone for 36 months. So in their case agreement and their assigned case manager, they serve as a dual role. It's not just for carrying out that court agreement. They can be, they're serving as a probation supervision agent at no cost to that person. So they're carrying for 36 months. When they're doing successful, that's whenever we second that conversation and incentivize them with education. So we've served over 1,600 people in court services. In pretrial, in post-adjudication, we're about 600. So we're seeing them already negotiate their cases, and some are still waiting for their court cases to be resolved. So it's a big ebb and flow process, but it's a constant feed of people, and this is an incentive for them.
In Weber County, you know, you have agencies referring them. In our county, we just have law enforcement. Sometime after booking, we
that's one way to get it.
You know, one of the things that you ask counties to do is experiment and innovate.
Yeah, exactly.
And so this is an experimentation and innovation. And one of the reasons we thought about this and talked to Charmaine, and I'm sure she's been grateful for me volunteering this. Is when we talk about innovation, I knew that would come with the responsibility of tracking. And I knew, well, gee, we're already tracking these people. It would be really easy for us to keep the data and be able to report back. And so, and of course, Charmaine, like she says, she loves data. And so between that, we'll be able to give some data back as we try to solve this problem. It's obviously a different population than normal, but... in my thoughts as a county commissioner, our largest budget is public safety. We're going to pay one way or another, right? If we don't invest here, they're all going to be down at my sheriff's hotel more frequently than they should. And the saddest part is that this is great human potential, and this is a great tragedy with addiction in all of our communities and our families. But if we can somehow... get them off and get them on the track, it'll help their sobriety, it'll help them overcome, and hopefully we'll break that stuff.
Well, again, the recidivism rates are increasing, and this is a way to, you know, to break that.
It is. And I, you know, one of our targets for me personally is that 54% that are not two generations, but they're one, it's only a matter of time.
Sure.
You know, because I'm not asking our kids these questions because they're the second generation. So I realized that when they actually have a stable home, that they're able to not move and relocate and, you know, basically worry where they're going to eat that next month or where things are going to be impounded cars. We had a female from another agency get sent over a referral, and she was supposed to come in for the face-to-face assessment because we're very thorough on crossing our T's and dotting our I's and letting them know where our commitment is to them and where their commitment is to us. But she was supposed to come in. We got a phone call, and she actually had a child. She needed impound fees because her car is in the impound. And how is she going to bring that baby home? So it was troubleshooting with multiple partner agencies. Who's going to go to the hospital? Who's going to do this? Just to surround that person for that one moment in their time. During one of the most biggest events of their life. So we're going to be
there. That's our one-to-one attention, right? We don't, you just don't call the whatever agency for driving babies home and, you know,
No.
We don't have that.
No, you don't. No. They won't do car delivery either. We'll find that out. So, yeah. Never hurts to ask. But so thank you for your time, because I really feel next year our numbers will be better, even if the funding goes away. But we'd like to encourage you guys to realize, you know, we use the dollars wisely. We access other funding, heat assistance programs, housing from the St. George Housing Authority, Switchpoint has the Section 8 voucher grant. But all of our pillars are really trying to target affordable housing, accountable, sustainable housing is what we're referencing it to, because, you know, our growth population is the highest, you know, in the state. And I don't know if it's the weather or, you know, if it's going to actual, you know, it's the water. We, you know, that's a good one to teach it. But with that being said, we just know that we've got to do something. We've got to do it together.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Commissioner Iverson, anything from the county?
We met in Ridgeville as far as the county subcommittee, and just once again, great work by your staff. Tracy just fantastic, and TJ just doing great work. I felt like we had a really good meeting. I thought it was pretty vibrant, and we had a great discussion. We had some great presentations there. I think a couple things that I want to report back is that the counties continue to implement their plan. I was always a little bit worried about this experiment of asking counties to do plans. I was hopeful that it would just be a planning process that just died off later. I'm happy to report that we're still moving ahead. Counties are still pushing forward at different speeds. Of course, it's been great to have these two presentations to kind of show you that there's stuff going on. Out of that discussion, just so you know, of course, we had that request to the state legislature 2 years ago for this innovation funding that have gone back to several different counties. And we're going to, you know, we don't want to sound like we're going rogue, but you know how counties are. You know we go a little rogue sometimes.
I was one of those.
Yeah. So our discussion yesterday, and, you know, Tracy, I always wonder what she thinks.
She tells me.
But what we feel is that I understood the state legislature was quite, they were questioning whether or not this funding was being spent appropriately and whatnot. We feel like in order to really start to get information back on best practices and on what's going on, we need to have a few more years in a couple pilot programs. And so we as a family of counties are going to support Weber County's request to go and ask for 3 years of funding to up their program to about 200 families.
250.
And we feel like with that, we'd like to put a request in for Paiute County. So basically we have a large and a small county. Of course, Paiute County is not going to be anywhere near the type of investment that Weber County is. But out of those two, if the legislature gives that funding, it'll help us go a little longer so that we can actually report back. And so it's great to have Scott, you know, with his past experience with the legislature, kind of understanding, you know, how we're going to be asking for that and where that money is going to end up and how the reporting is going to go back. But that's something we wanted to report back to this committee. We approach this legislative session. Weber County has been kind of preparing to make that request on their own. And I think us coming in to the counties and saying we support that, and this is why I think the state legislature will appreciate that. So anyway, that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, don't tell the governor you have that.
Oh, that's very good.
Yeah, and the Kenneth grants that are out there.
Yeah.
And then this will be an addition to that.
The governor doesn't need anything anymore.
Definitely don't tell him that. No, again, it is important. It absolutely is important. And this is a big deal. And I think we're seeing the momentum. Being able to scale it, as Van mentioned, I mean, if we get up to 250 families and show that it's working, I mean, I mean this too. It might be the most important thing that's happening. So.
And with that, I think it's important to report that we have three more counties that are going to prepare and write plans, right?
So we identified three more counties that were our next step.
You want to roll right into that?
Yeah, go right into that. So Department of Workforce Service asked us to identify an additional three counties for the 2020 year. What we did, we contacted our service area directors and gave them some data and say, hey, look at this. Are there any counties on this list that might show interest? And if so, we can reach out to them. And so they did. Let me get my notes here.
Winners are?
Box Elder, Drew Abbott, and Tula counties were identified counties. So our next step with them is to reach out to them, see if they want to have a meeting with us. We can share some data, talk about what's going on with the IGP or Intergenerational Poverty Initiative, and we'll go from there.
Very good. Any questions on that? I think it's great. Again, the more we can get in. Very familiar with all three of those counties and some of their challenges, and I think they would benefit. And conversely, I think they can help the rest of the counties as well. Just great people. So, okay. All right. We're getting close, guys. I know it's been a long, long day, and I sure appreciate everybody sticking around. Agenda item number 6, these are the advisory committee endorsements for the 2020 activities. We've talked about one of those, one that's not on here, but let's go ahead and talk about the Classroom on Wheels project.
Yeah, we have two others. Classroom on Wheels and the update for the trauma-informed care and practice that we talked about in the advisory committee. And I think some of you are aware of those, but Tracy, why don't you just outline those very briefly and take whatever questions that might be presented here.
Sure, thank you, Bishop. So there's two additional kind of 2020 priorities that the advisory committee endorsed at its last meeting, and one is the Classroom on Wheels, which is a partnership between the Department of Workforce Services, Office of Child Care, and the Department of Heritage and Arts to convert one of their STEM buses into a high-quality preschool classroom with a STEM emphasis, yes, thank you, focus, to go into one of the high IGP counties that is lacking in any early childhood resources. We are in the extremely early stages of talking to Heritage and Arts. Both agencies are very excited about this possibility. There's a very positive model in Nevada, in one of their rural counties, that we are looking at and exploring to see best practice and dosage and how do you set it up in a mobile way, and we are moving forward with the support of this work, this commission on that. The next is the Center for Trauma-Informed Care Practice, Resilient Center for Resilient Utah. They came, that subcommittee, which was established by this commission, came to the commission and advisory back in August with the, after some surveys that were done, to start exploring the possibility of having a Center for Resilient Utah, which is basically a Center for Trauma-Informed Care and Practice. That, too, is in the very early planning stages with the support of the Lieutenant Governor. We've met once and we'll have a larger meeting in February to try to put forward, to develop a project plan. We have a pretty strong concept. It needs some details and some work to figure out what the next steps are, and that's our next phase.
Thank you, Tracy. Questions relative to that? This is a work in progress, but work that the advisory committee has been aware of and endorses at this stage. So I think that's
important.
You as the chair can probably just say, yeah, let's go ahead and do that.
Are there any concerns with moving forward?
I don't know.
Of course,
seeing none.
We've been reporting back.
We're going to go forward.
We're going to go.
I love it. We need more decisions out. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other business. I think we had our fill. All right, I would put for a motion to adjourn. Actually, we're closed. I hereby declare we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.